We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist Christina Asquith went to Baghdad on assignment in 2003. When the insurgency strengthened the following year, she lived in hiding in the home of two Iraqi women, sisters she had befriended. We'll talk with Asquith this afternoon about that Iraqi family's experience of the war, as well as the attempt to bring women's rights to Iraq. There are five central figures here, sisters Zia and Nunu and their mother, Memina, and two American women, a U.S. Army lieutenant, Heather Coyne, and Manal Omar, an aid worker, women's rights activist, and observant Muslim who had protested the war, participated in anti-war rallies in Washington. Theirs are the stories Christina Asquith tells in her book, Sisters in War, a story of love, family, and survival in the new Iraq. Christina Asquith, who is currently teaching about women in Islam at the University of Vermont, has written for The New York Times, The Economist, The Christian Science Monitor, and The Guardian, among others. She was a staff writer for 2 years at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Her honors include being named the Upton Sinclair Education Journalist of the Year. In addition to Sisters in War, she is the author of The Emergency Teacher. You'll find our guest online at www.christinaasquith.com. Sisters in War, a story of love, family, and survival in the new Iraq is published by Random House. Listeners, your telephone calls are invited this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Christina Asquith, thank you. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Your book opens with these sisters, Zia and Nunu, cheering on military planes in March of 2003, and you describe one of them as shouting, "Go, good luck, but don't kill any innocent people." What were the hopes of these two women at that moment for the war?
Zia and Nunu were young at the start of the war. They were 18 and 21 years old. They had suffered horribly under Saddam's Iraq, as millions of other Iraqis had. They weren't able to pursue their dreams to go on to into the medical profession because their father wasn't a part of Saddam's political party. The UN sanctions, which had started after Saddam invaded Kuwait, had really punished the average Iraqi in very basic ways. They mother struggled to get food on the table. They couldn't. They often didn't have the appropriate medicines to address very basic health issues. Their brother was driven out of the country because the mother feared that he would be recruited into Saddam's war with Iran. So the family, you know, they hated Saddam and they felt that the country was asphyxiating slowly. On the other hand, had a really positive image of America, kind of streets were paved with gold impression, and they thought that America was not only going to liberate them from Saddam, this horrible tyrant, but was going to rebuild their country in the image of the kinds of American cities that they had seen in movies.
Their hopes were also built on a foundation of stories their mother, Memina, told them about freedoms enjoyed before the rule of Saddam Hussein began in 1979. What kind of stories had they heard growing up from their mother?
Absolutely. Well, this is the great irony of, you know, of Saddam's Iraq, that, you know, women did well in Iraq in the beginning of his regime, and women were fairly progressive in Iraq in the 50s and 60s, and, you know, the first 10 or 15 years of Saddam's regime in the 70s and early 80s. You know, Saddam was a socialist, essentially. His political party, the Ba'ath Party, was the socialist party that believed in equality for women. He spent a lot of the oil wealth that the country had on women's education, and it wasn't unusual to see female lawyers, female doctors, engineers in Iraq. That, you know, began to change in the 90s as the country suffered under the sanctions, and women just had less opportunities. And it continued into 2001, 2002, as Saddam really kind of befriended the Islamicists out of fear that, you know, they were challenging his regime. So he took a kind of swerve towards religious radicals, and one of the, you know, results of that was that he condemned women's equality.
Mm. Did that shift come as a result of sanctions directly?
Yeah, I think it did. I think that Iraq became a much more religious country in the 90s because people were finding it hard to find something to eat. So you saw in their desperation, people turned towards religion. And Saddam, you know, responded to that by turning, albeit in phony ways, towards religion himself.
Mm. Now, Mamina and Baba, the parents of Zia and Nunu, are Shia. What were the parents' views of women's rights and religion?
They believed, as many Muslims do, that Islam should be separate from politics. And they had a very, almost looked their nose down on political Islam or on clerics who involved themselves in the political process. And this is a tradition that goes back hundreds of years in the Arab world. So I think that while they were religious, they didn't subscribe to the more more extreme acts of Islam. For example, they would let their daughters wear trousers. They were allowed to wear makeup. They didn't veil. They were certainly expected, the daughters were expected to have driver's licenses, to go to college, to have careers. And they didn't see any kinds of inconsistencies with Islam in letting them their daughters do this. They even wanted their daughters to select their own husband, although in keeping with Islam, they certainly wouldn't have expected their daughters to have any sort of private communication or physical contact with their husband, with their fiancé before marriage.
Yeah. Also interesting to read that Baba, the father, took a very dim view of honor killings.
Yeah, I mean, honor killings, you know, most Muslims find this act to be atrocious. I think it's, and many of them will tell you it's actually comes from tribal traditions, not from Islam. So, you know, I mean, honor killings, it's often the father who does the killing of his own daughter to supposedly restore honor to a family after the daughter has supposedly committed some sort of act like adultery or been a victim of rape that's brought shame supposedly onto the name of the family. I mean, they you know, the father, Baba, in my book, he's an educated man. He received his PhD in Europe, and he considered that kind of practice of honor killings to be absolutely barbaric.
Mm-hmm. Yet these so-called honor killings ripple throughout your book. What is going on today in terms of Iraqi so-called honor killings for these murders, and how did the invasion and war and subsequent upheaval and chaos feed into this situation?
You know, honor killings, it's one of the hardest things to measure because they are not reported. And in many societies, the police will just look the other way. They will just count it as a death. They won't consider it a murder. And in Iraq under Saddam, the punishment for a man who commits a murder and the so-called honor killing was reduced to something like 3 months in prison. And that's not unusual in the Arab world right now. The Iraqi women, especially the women activists who I highlight in my book, wanted desperately to change this in Iraq. It changing it happens in two ways. You change the legal framework so that men are actually, so this is considered a crime, first of all, and that men are punished for it. But then you have to change the societal views about it, change the way that people view so-called shame and whether or not a woman deserves to be punished by death for committing so-called shameful acts. Changing people's views about this, that it's really been entrenched in society for hundreds of years, is not an easy thing to do. And unfortunately, what happened in Iraq after the U.S. arrived was rather than move views forward in terms of women's equality and women's liberation, I think you saw a lot of Iraqis retreating back into very conservative points of view. And I don't think that's unusual when you look at a country that's been bombed, the government they've had for 30 years has been overthrown. There's foreign soldiers on their streets. There's chaos. There's looting. There's no police force. And those kinds of that kind of insecurity, it's certainly not unusual to see people retreat into the traditional way, the kind of things that they know, and often towards a greater embracement of religion.
Yeah, let's talk now about another central figure in the story, the aid worker, the Muslim American, Manal Omar. She had lived in Baghdad. She had also taken part in anti-war rallies in Washington. Eventually, she went to Iraq to help women there. What was her view of the impending invasion, and what problems did she see on the horizon?
You know, Manal is, I had more fun working with Manal on this book than anyone else because she's so unusual. She's kind of really a Muslim suffragette. She is veiled, but she wears designer headscarves. She's a practicing Muslim, but she's outspoken. She's career-oriented. She played basketball in high school in a hijab in South Carolina. I mean, she really, all her life, has broken the stereotypes that Americans have about Muslim women. Because she's worked for so long in the Muslim world and in the developing world, her message at the start of the war was that you cannot bring women's rights to a country through the barrel of a gun. Whenever you invade a country or whenever you have some sort of military action in a country, the result is always insecurity. And insecurity is always bad for women. Women are always caught in the middle in the worst ways when there's civil unrest. That's exactly what happened in Iraq.
Were there many Muslim women, women who lived or had lived in Iraq, that held a similar point of view to hers?
I think Iraqi women were divided. Mm. They very much, even the family that I write about in Zia and Nunu, most Iraqis did not want to continue living the way they had been living under Saddam Hussein. But, of course, who wants to have their city bombed? I mean, who wants to have their neighborhood literally having bombs dropping on their neighborhood? Having foreign soldiers who they're very naturally suspicious of. Iraqi women, in most cases, had never met an American, let alone an American soldier who's carrying an M16 and a grenade and, you know, Ray-Ban and a helmet and big dusty boots. It's a formidable image to have walking down the street where you grew up, and it's the unknown. And it was very scary. And, of course, on top of that, there were lots of atrocities committed against Iraqis by U.S. forces. I don't think the majority of U.S. soldiers did this, but there were incidents, and those incidents were stories of those incidents spread rapidly through the Iraqi population. So there was a lot of fear about the U.S. presence in Iraq. And I think that's why whenever I would interview an Iraqi, ask them, do you want the Americans to stay or go, I would get, over the course of the answer, you know, both replies.
Hmm. When did Manal Omar go back to Iraq, and what work did she undertake?
Well, she went to Iraq at the start of the war in the summer of 2003, and she was the head of Women for Women International, which is a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that helps women throughout the world in developing countries. And her job was essentially to help promote women's rights, to help train women who were in jobs. And eventually, she was also trying to set up a letter-writing campaign between U.S. women and Iraqi women. And the idea was to exchange the experiences, both women, and create a greater understanding between the two cultures. But what she ended up doing was a little bit more different. She got involved with the soldier in my book, Captain or Lieutenant Coyne, in building women's centers across the country. They had a very large grant to do this, several million dollars, and the hope was to build a center like a kind of YMCA, for women, where Iraqi women would come and they would receive training to run for political office, receive jobs training, and be able to just support themselves in any way that they might need, from getting food for poor families to just being kind of an emotional shoulder to cry on when things were getting really difficult in Iraq.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Christina Asquith. She went to Baghdad on assignment in 2003. She is the author of the new book, Sisters in War, A Story of Love, Family, and Survival in the New Iraq. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Heather Coyne is another very interesting woman in this story. At one point, you describe her like this. She wanted to be on the front lines and out in the world, getting her hands dirty, doing good, and she recognized little contradiction in delivering the message of goodwill from behind the barrel of a gun. Of course, that changes as her experience of war and the situation in Iraq deepens. Tell us a little bit about Lieutenant Heather Coyne and what motivated her to join the Army.
Lieutenant Coyne is very much represents the kind of American woman that I know. She grew up in the suburbs. Her parents were both professors. She was raised in a peaceful community, went to public high school. She, like a lot of Americans, myself included, had ingrained in her at a very young age this idea that America had a moral obligation to go out into the world and do good. And in the case of Iraq, Heather and I are about the same age. We were in high school when Saddam invaded Kuwait, and we remember the images of his gassing of the Kurds. For Heather, that image really stuck, and she always felt that it was an outrage that the U.S. could allow that kind of rogue dictator and a human rights abuser to exist in today and not do anything about it. And, you know, it's that kind of earnestness and that kind of goodwill that I saw a lot of in Iraq. And I was fascinated with watching the way that Heather could reconcile her ambitions for Iraq with the fact that she and the U.S. administration in Iraq really knew very little about how to go about, quote-unquote, helping Iraqis. And in the case of Heather, how to go about bringing American feminism, U.S. women's rights, to a Muslim country. What would that mean? What would that look like? And did Iraqi women even want to be like American women? Was this really liberating them? You know, Heather spoke some Arabic, but she had never been to the Middle East. And I think her relationship with Manal plays a big role in schooling Heather about how to be more sensitive to Arab women, and she kind of teaches Heather that maybe Arab women don't exactly see themselves as being, quote-unquote, liberated in the same way that U.S. women see themselves.
Hmm. Is there something else, anything else that we should know that we could learn from in terms of Heather Coyne's understanding the lives of Iraqi women and how she came to that understanding?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you an example from the book. Heather is unmarried in the story. She's a single woman in her early 30s, and she doesn't intend to have children. And it's a decision that she has thought a lot about and just come to terms with. She very much wants to have a career, and she doesn't think that you can balance both. when she is in the workplace with her Iraqi colleagues, and she tells them that, they become friends after almost a year of working together, and sometimes they veer into personal topics, and Heather very casually tells them this. They're absolutely shocked, and they're suspicious. Her Iraqi colleagues cannot accept the fact that she would not want to be married and would not want to have children. And rumors start that she's a lesbian, that she's a prostitute, all sorts of horrible things. And Heather finds herself dealing with these kind of office drama. It certainly wasn't what she went into Iraq to do. But it was, I think, a lesson to her early on, that the gulf between the Iraqi women's vision for themselves and American women's vision for themselves is still pretty huge.
What is her assessment of what happened, what went wrong in Iraq?
I stay in touch with all these women, and I was just speaking with Heather the other day. She's about to ship off to Afghanistan. Heather was disappointed with the way that Iraq went, obviously, as most Americans there were. And she felt that the military was left with the role of rebuilding the country. Forget about toppling an army and keeping the peace. It really fell into the military's hands to rebuild Iraqi government and Iraqi society. And Heather felt that the military was just not at all prepared to do that kind of work, and that if we want to be successful in the 21st century, in going out into these developing nations and rebuilding them both economically, politically, and socially, and in doing so, defeating the kinds of factors that lead to terrorism, then the U.S. military needs to be trained in nation building. And that was what I think Heather took away from that experience. And she has spent the last couple of years studying nation building, studying how to work in cultures that are very foreign from ours, and helping them help themselves. And I think that's what she's now going to take with her as she goes off to Afghanistan next month.
Hmm. Have these critiques by women like Lieutenant Kowaina and Manal Omar, the aid worker, have they been taken to heart? Have we learned from them?
I like to think so.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I certainly think that the Obama administration and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton are more grounded in this notion that this isn't an us versus them. This isn't a Christian versus Islam clash. These issues are very much more nuanced and much more shaded. And, I just heard this morning on the radio, actually, that military generals are now reading Greg Mortensen's book, Three Cups of Tea. That, and along with the kind of experiences that I relay in my book, I think in some sense can help educate people to this idea that of what these cultures in these countries that we're going to, what the people there think of all this, what they want, what their hopes are, and how we can really work better with them by building relationships with them instead of what I view as the kind of Cold War way of doing things, of just dropping bombs on them and thinking that, if we crush their military, then we can, things will be better. In fact, that only has made things worse in Iraq.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to read Manal Omar's thoughts about being on the ground, forgive the cliche, and being with the people, and the people who are needed to build and rebuild shouldn't be carrying guns, and it should be kept small and grassroots, and the concertina barbed wire should be banned.
You put your finger exactly on the dilemma that Manal and Lieutenant Heather Coyne used to argue about all the time. I mean, I just said that, Heather wants to have the military playing this peacekeeping role. Well, Manal would say back to her, as would much of the aid community, that it is inappropriate to have an armed soldier trying to, quote-unquote, work with the local leaders or work with women's rights activists. They are not an objective body. They have military goals, mm-hmm. and they represent the U.S. administration, whereas the aid community likes to think of themselves as a neutral body, and their only goal is to deliver aid. They're not interested in political victory, in economic supremacy. That the U.S. military, by virtue of the fact that they are representing the, you know, the U.S. as a country, they do have these goals. So I'm not sure that, you know, Manal and the aid community feels very comfortable with the idea of soldiers going into these places and doing peacekeeping and peace building.
Mm. Is Heather Coyne, will she be career military?
No, she's a reservist.
She's a reservist. Okay. Yeah.
She, you know, her other job is at the United States Institute of Peace, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Boy, I wonder what it's like for her to juggle all this.
I think she likes to think of herself as the kind of, oh, I think she is the kind of, you know, the brains in the military. She's a thinking soldier, and I actually feel really good about the fact that there are women very well-educated and very theoretical women in the military representing an alternate side to the issue.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Christina Asquith. She went to Baghdad on assignment in 2003. She is the author of Sisters in War, A Story of Love, Family, and Survival in the New Iraq. We're talking with her this afternoon about an Iraqi family's experience of the war, as well as the attempt to bring women's rights to Iraq. There are five central figures in Sisters in War, Sisters Zia and Nuno, and their mother, Mamina, and two American women, a U.S. Army lieutenant, Heather Coyne, and Manal Omar, an aid worker, women's rights activist, and observant Muslim who had protested the war, had participated in anti-war rallies in Washington, D.C., before the invasion of Iraq. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to return to the sisters and their parents. What was their experience of the war as it continued after the initial euphoria?
They quickly realized that with the arrival of the U.S., the pillars of Iraqi society had crumbled. The police department, namely, had just disappeared. Police officers weren't afraid to show up for work. And, you know, imagine any society without a police department. As a result, women felt terrified to go out into the streets. There were stories that of women being abducted and being raped. And, of course, rape, as horrible as it is anywhere in the world, in Iraq, can, you know, is even more unimaginable because a woman who is raped, she has to face the fear of being a victim of an honor killing by her family under accusations of bringing shame onto the family. She certainly will never find a husband or never receive a marriage proposal if she's been sullied in this way. So most fathers, rather than tell their daughters that they now have these newfound freedoms under U.S. democracy, we're telling them, no, stay in the house. If you leave, even to go to university or go to school, you can only leave when I drive you somewhere. There were all sorts of other problems going on the first couple of years after the war. There was horrible looting. There was very little electricity. Traffic lights didn't work. So there were horrible traffic jams. So, you know, just thinking in terms of the story of the sisters that I follow, the youngest one was trying to get her education at Baghdad University. She was finding it difficult to have the light to study, to get to school, just very basic obstacles. And, you know, things got worse before they got better in Iraq, because into this power vacuum in around 2006, 2007, stepped very radical religious terrorists, really, and they started wielding their power over women in these neighborhoods by telling them to veil, telling them to wear long skirts, telling them they had to quit their jobs and stay out of the universities. or else. And many of them, as a result, many young women who dared to challenge them were killed as a result.
Yeah, and Zia and her father came close.
Yeah, there were several instances in which Zia was almost killed, but the worst one was when she was followed out of the U.S. headquarters in Baghdad by a man with a knife, chased them all over the city, and tried to behead her.
Yeah. She was working as a translator.
She started as a translator, but she worked her way up very quickly to a manager inside the U.S. headquarters in Baghdad. So she was overseeing hundreds of Iraqis as a manager at a news station that the U.S. had created called Iraqi Media Network. And she had working under her, mostly Iraqi men. And, they didn't like this. Mm. She made lots of enemies because of it.
There's also an anecdote in the book that I'm recalling now where she is translating for journalists. And she's so frustrated because the poor journalists, people like you, I don't know what your story is, maybe we can talk about that, but you land in a place that is foreign and maybe you're not well prepared to go there. You've got to sort out what the story is. And from her point of view, the reporters that she was working with, at least in this one anecdote, were missing the story.
Yeah, well, everybody brings their biases to these situations. And the U.S. media was, after kind of building up the case to go to war and this case that there were WMDs in Iraq, really then found themselves with egg on their face when there were no WMDs and the country was accusing the media of falsely leading them into the war. Next, you see the media really swerving in the other direction and being extremely critical of the U.S. efforts to in Iraq. Zia, that was the U.S. media's bias. I think Zia and many other Iraqis who welcomed the Americans, their bias was for the Americans. They wanted very much to see the Americans succeed in Iraq. They definitely wanted to see stability brought to their country, to see democracy flourish, to see these insurgents and these terrorists get driven out of the country. And, Zia would be at a press conference with these U.S. reporters who were raining down criticisms on the military generals and on Ambassador Bremer, who headed the U.S. occupation. And Zia was saying, stop criticizing them. We think we need their support. We need you to keep in this war. The worst thing you can do right now is to withdraw the troops and to leave the war. So, you saw the way different people viewed the war for their own personal reasons.
Mm. When you went to Iraq on assignment, that first assignment for the New York Times, what were your expectations?
Oh, I was I had never been to the Middle East. I had never covered a war before, and I brought several headscarves. I thought I was definitely going to have to veil. I didn't think that Iraqi women would be nearly as educated or outspoken or as strong-willed as I found them to be. I thought that I would be, dodging bullets, wearing a bulletproof vest everywhere I went, in a heavily armed car. And, what happened is that's how it all ended up by 2005. But when I first got there in 2003, things were very calm. Iraqis were, very elated to meet an American, very welcoming. And for about 6 months, there was a sense of euphoria in the country, a sense of endless possibility. And it was, it was a good time for us. I mean, people, it was an amazing moment as a journalist to be there and be witnessing history. And I, too, felt, optimistic that things were going to go well in Iraq, but that wasn't what ended up happening.
Yeah. When and how did you begin to see you were in the midst of a very complex struggle?
When we started to get stories into the newsroom of Iraqis being very brutally murdered, women's rights activists being found on the side of the road, beheaded, with death notes pinned to their clothes saying, to other women who don't veil, you will meet this kind of fate. Stories coming up from the provinces, from the rural areas, about women being dragged out of the workplace and publicly whipped. You couldn't really pin these stories down in the beginning. People were very afraid to talk. There were some areas that were very dangerous to get to, but you would just hear rumors, and those rumors became more and more common, and you began to realize that there was an enormous population that was unhappy with the American presence in Iraq, that did not want to see women's rights in America's understanding of women's rights be brought to Iraq, and that they were willing to, you know, to murder in order to protect what they thought was the Muslim way that women should live.
Oh. Also complicating things, we haven't really talked much about this, was the religious climate at the outset of the war. It's clearly very tense in this family that you got to know. At the time of the invasion, they were living in Hit, and most of the city's residents were Sunni, and the family is Shia, and there was an intermarriage here. But here you foreshadow what erupts later. The religious climate at the outset of the war was tense, and how tense was it at the outset, and what are your observations about how that blew up?
Well, you know, Iraqis, it was not unusual to have Sunnis and Shias married, friends, intermingling in Iraq at all. Same as, you know, Christians and Jews in this country. But because of the war, you know, the people were pushed into more extreme views that they had during peaceful times. In terms of religion and women, you know, you see a vast array of opinions on women's rights in Iraq, much as you see them in this country. I mean, you know, we think that we all are the same in this country in terms of our views for women and women's equality, but, you know, you have Hillary Clinton and you have Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm.
You had Phyllis Schlafly and you had Gloria Steinem. And in Iraq, it's the exact same thing. You have women who think that you should not show your ankles and you should not speak with your husband, who should be found for you by your father, until your wedding night. And you have your urban, college-bound, more modern women who don't veil and who believe that women should receive equal inheritance to their husband, and who even believe in abortion rights in Iraq. These kinds of outlooks on women existed more or less peacefully side by side in Iraq under Saddam, as they do in America. But once the war kind of threw everything up in the air, all the legal books were tossed aside, everything was going to be rewritten, and the question of how women ought to live suddenly was on the table. You saw women absolutely taking corners and feeling very, very passionately about either veiling or not veiling for one issue, and really becoming divided in a way that they hadn't been under Saddam.
How long after the invasion was it that Oprah came to Iraqi television?
Oprah arrived instantly on the heels of the troops. The Iraqis weren't allowed to see Western television for the most part under Saddam. They had only three channels, and most of it was political propaganda. So, you know, they lived in a Rip Van Winkle sleep until the Americans came and the borders opened. And, you know, it's completely natural. The first thing the Iraqis want is, well, internet, cell phones, satellite television. They had this, you know, forbidden for them for years. And so when women got a taste of Oprah, I mean, this country, our country went kind of crazy for Oprah in the 80s. It was, if you can think back then, it was a shocking television show back then, to have women up on stage exposing their very personal, very intimate problems to the audience, talking openly about taboo subjects like molestation and abuse. You know, we weren't used to that kind of thing in the 80s, and believe me, Iraqi women certainly were not used to it. So they found it fascinating. I think they found Oprah to be very empowering. I think Oprah sends a really positive message to women that they have feelings that matter, that their rights count, that they should be able to stand up for themselves. And, you know, Iraqi women, they like women anywhere. I think they like this message a lot.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Christina Asquith. Her book. Her latest book is Sisters in War, a story of love, family, and survival in the new Iraq. We've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you've got a question or comment, join us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have also written about women's rights in Afghanistan, among other places. What would you like us to know about women's rights in Afghanistan?
Women in Afghanistan are much more conservative than women in Iraq. I think the first thing I'd like people to know is that you can't lump these two societies together. Afghan women follow a much more conservative brand of Islam. They have not had access to the kinds of education that Iraqi women have. They certainly have not had the oil wealth that Iraq has had, so their standard of living is much lower in Afghanistan. Iraqi women never saw themselves as fighting for the right to go to school, elementary school, middle school. They were allowed to do that under Saddam. In Afghanistan, that is still very much on the table with the Taliban. I think that, there's a push right now in Afghanistan to protect the most basic of women's rights, the right not to have to wear the burqa, which is, the cloth that it's like a curtain that completely covers your face, and you can only see through a small grill that shows your eyes. I wore one of those while I was over there, and it's absolutely claustrophobic. Women in Iraq certainly would never have been seen wearing something like that. So I think the battle is much larger in Afghanistan, and much more frightening to think that if we lose it and if the Taliban resurfaces, the horrible human rights that will go on in that country as a result.
Mm. Back to Lieutenant Coyne, how does she feel about what the president has decided to do, and what are her hopes for what will happen in Afghanistan, given what we know now about what happened in Iraq?
I don't know exactly what Heather thinks about the President Obama's decision to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, but knowing her, I can certainly say that she represents a part of the country that feels like we have an obligation still to Afghanistan to not leave them in a situation that is as worse or as worse as it was when we arrived. And that I think she would also say that the threat of al-Qaeda and of insurgent activity in Pakistan is very serious, and that the best thing that we can do for these countries is to develop them economically and socially and create some sort of stability in which they can then protect themselves against more radical and extreme minority, which is what the Taliban is. They're a minority.
What are these women doing today, the women that we've concentrated here today on, Zia, Nunu, their mother, Mamina, Lieutenant Coyle, we know, is about to be deployed to Afghanistan, and Manal Omar?
Manal Omar is back in Baghdad. She heads the United States Institute of Peace's office in Baghdad. She's still there on the ground working on behalf of women's rights. Zia and Nunu, at the outset of the book, I make it very clear that while we have all of these grand hopes for bringing women's rights to Iraq, the hopes that these girls have in their homes, in their neighborhood in Baghdad, more than anything else, is to get married. Getting married in Iraq is not like getting married in the U.S. If you don't find a husband there, you will live with your parents for the rest of your life. You will be socially ostracized. You will probably not be able to have a career, and you will really be considered a spinster in a very negative way, in a way that maybe we looked at women, 50 or 100 years ago. Something's kind of wrong with them because they're not married. So these girls dreamed of getting married, and they spend a lot of the book really kind of sorting through the obstacles, the cultural obstacles, the traditional religious obstacles, and then on top of all of that, the obstacles that the war and the occupation bring to them in finding a husband. This is all to say that I don't want to tell you what happens at the end of the book. I don't want to tell your audience what happens at the end of the book, whether or not they fall in love and are successful in meeting the man of their dreams, because I don't want to ruin the story. Even as I was writing the book and I followed their lives for 5 years, I had so many moments in which I hung up the phone with them. I would call them when I was back in the U.S. and they were still in their homes in Baghdad. I would call their cell phones and interview them. And I would worry that that would be the last time I would speak to them. I just didn't know if they were going to survive the war. And I try and build that tension in the book because I want people to realize how seriously this war affected them and how at stake was their lives, their very survival. So I think that's all I'm going to say about their story.
Also in the book, it comes through how all of this just takes a toll on your heart and your soul and your mind. One last question. Can you tell us very quickly, Manal Omar, I've mentioned a couple of times, this is an anti-war activist in addition to being, a women's rights activist. What's her thinking about where we are today?
You know, this is the quandary. We had a Republican president that took us into, that invaded a country to bring democracy. These are complicated issues now. How are we going to bring peace and stability to a place like Afghanistan if we're not willing to, use weapons to overthrow a very evil group of people like the Taliban? And I think that Manal is very mature and very sophisticated in looking at the problem in this way, in realizing that the aid community can no longer be anti-war. It is not simple enough to say, make love, not war. We can't do that anymore. And so I think that Manal wrestles with the ethical dilemma that she, is working alongside the military to bring peace and bring women's rights to these countries. And I think that's an ethical dilemma that we as a country need to keep talking about, to keep thinking about and working out.
There we have to leave it. Christina, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Christina Asquith is the author of Sisters in War, A Story of Love, Family, and Survival in the New Iraq. The book is published by Random House. And you'll find our guest, Christina Asquith, online at www.christinaasquith.com. Asquith.